It is Tuesday, October 22nd, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Ozarks at Large is sponsored in part by the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs and research through a collective voice. The Eureka Springs Original Ozark Folk Festival presents a live recording of Michael Jonathan's Wood Songs Old Time Radio Hour Saturday in the City Auditorium. Guests include Michael Martin Murphy and Leroy Troy and the Tennessee Mafia Jug Band. A limited number of tickets are available online at theaud.org.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, the underappreciated parts of the United States Constitution, Sanford Levinson, the author of the book Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance, discusses the parts of the documents many of us are unfamiliar with or don't think about that often. Plus, a new report issued today from the Pew Commission on Industrial Farm Animal Production examines animal agriculture in the United States.
And zombies hit the stage at Arts Live in Fayetteville just in time for Halloween.
But first, Congressman Tim Griffin dropped a political bombshell yesterday, announcing he will not seek re-election. The Republican from Arkansas's 2nd District said the decision was made because of his family.
It's something that my wife and I have been talking about, praying about for about 5 or 6, maybe 7 months, and decided to finish my 2nd term, of course, but did not seek a 3rd term. And, when I got elected, I had an infant and a 3-year-old, and we were able to manage pretty easily. It's gotten a little more difficult.
Griffin says he doesn't know what he'll do at the end of his term, but that he will return to Little Rock and hopes to work in some form of public service. In November, Griffin was named to the powerful U.S. House Ways and Means Committee, becoming the first Republican from Arkansas to serve on the tax writing panel. At the time, Griffin said he wouldn't run for Arkansas governor or the U.S. Senate because of the appointment. Several possible Democratic candidates are considering running for the seat.
Governor Mike Beebe yesterday signed bills passed over the weekend in a special session, which partially reduce a rise in public school employee insurance premiums. The session was called to address both short and long-term fixes, but some of the reforms have yet to be crafted. Ongoing funding to mitigate premium increases will in part come from school facility and teacher development funds. But Beebe says that's just one part of a more permanent fix.
The second part of the long-term solution is a systemic change, which we never thought you could do in 3 days. It was always contemplated that that was going to take some in-depth study, some testimony, and you couldn't do that in 3 days. That's going to take a year or at least several months.
He says it's too soon to tell if efforts to fix the program will turn around enrollment trends.
In terms of getting more participation, I think you're going to have to wait until we see what the task force comes up with in terms of systemic changes before we know whether or not we'll be able to get increased participation. I think you'll have to see what the plans end up being.
A 14-member task force made up of legislators, state employees, and teachers have until the end of June to come up with a plan. Legislation creating the task force stipulates one part of the fix must be the inclusion of deductibles and for the Employee Benefit Division Board to be reformed with new appointees.
A groundbreaking for Bentonville's $16 million community center could be set in the near future. That's if the City Council tonight approves a number of ordinances related to the project, dealing with issues including the construction contract with Crossland Construction, a joint use agreement for the center's pool with Bentonville Public Schools, and various budget adjustments. David Wright, the city's Parks and Recreation Director, says the community center project has been developed over the past 4 years. He says during that time, the project's design has been shaped in part by public input.
Our job over the last several years has been really twofold. One, we have to make sure that we're building a building that we can afford. So I've worked very closely with a construction management team, and we have analyzed every single amenity that is in this building. That goes from everything from the water faucets to the equipment in the basketball gymnasium. So literally, we haven't left anything unturned in looking at the design of the project and making sure that we're using our money the best way. And then the other side of that is that we had to save the money to do it.
To cover the majority share of the project's cost, Wright says the city took excess revenue and unused money at the end of the city's budget years, but a sizable portion of the project funding came from outside sources, which he says are crucial to making the project a reality.
We wouldn't be under construction today if it wasn't for some great partnerships that we have with organizations such as the Walton Family Foundation, the Bentonville Public Schools, the Bentonville Advertising and Promotions Commission, the CARE Foundation, and the Walmart Foundation. So, you know, of this $16 million, about $10 million comes directly from the city of Bentonville. But we're very, very appreciative of the organizations outside of the city there who believe in us enough to award us very large amounts of money to build this project.
Some of that outside funding includes $1 million from the Bentonville School District as part of the joint use agreement for the center's pool facilities, $1 million from the CARE Foundation, and $2 million from the Walton Family Foundation. Wright says that the site is ready to go, with the parking lot and roads already paved and underground utilities in place. He says if ground is broken in the next 2 months, the project could be completed by June 2015.
The Endeavor Foundation has announced more than $400,000 in grants to support Energize NWA, a community-led initiative to increase access to healthy food and physical activity. Grantees include sidewalks and bikeways in Bentonville and Fayetteville, school bike and safe routes to school programs, a neighborhood produce market at Tricycle Farms, an outdoor fitness trail and outdoor gym at the Fayetteville Boys and Girls Club, and other food and wellness programs in the area.
A detour near downtown Fayetteville will continue through tomorrow. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard will remain closed between Block and College Avenues as work continues to replace a failing stone culvert. The project was extended because of rain and complications working around utilities.
Mercy Hospital in Fort Smith has been awarded the Consumer Choice Award by the National Research Corporation. This marks the 10th consecutive year the hospital has received the award. It's one of 277 hospitals nationally and four in the state winning the award, chosen by consumers in National Research's nationally syndicated Market Insights Survey. The award is based on four metrics, including best overall quality, best reputation, best doctors, and best nurses.
Mostly clear tonight. Lows in northwest Arkansas around 34, lower 40. Tonight in the Arkansas River Valley. Sunny tomorrow, highs from 65 to 70. And tomorrow night, mostly clear, lows around 38 in northwest Arkansas, lows in the mid-40s tomorrow night for the Arkansas River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large. In 2008, the Pew Commission on Industrial Farm Animal Production issued its landmark study on animal agriculture. Commissioners have reconvened this week to release a new study by the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future on public policy impacts of the report. Their findings were presented at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. earlier today. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich has covered the commission since its inception. Commissioners visited the Ozarks several times, and she files this progress report.
The Pew Commission on Industrial Farm Animal Production was established in 2005 with a $2.6 million grant from the Pew Charitable Trusts to Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health to investigate public health, environmental, and animal welfare issues associated with concentrated animal agriculture. The 14-member commission included science, public policy, public health, animal welfare, veterinary, food industry, and rural society experts who visited industrial animal farms across the United States, hosted public meetings, conducted research, and sourced peer-reviewed technical reports. Its landmark study issued in 2008 found that animal industrial feeding operations, called AFOs, and large confined animal feeding operations, called CAFOs, posed an unacceptable risk to public health and the environment. Commission Executive Director Robert Martin, Director of Food Systems at Johns Hopkins University Center for a Livable Future, said many state and federal policymakers were receptive to the commission's findings.
The National Conference of State Legislatures had worked with us on one of our reports about the state-by-state laws and resources designated to regulate industrial animal production. And they said for about 3 or 4 years, it was the most popular publication they had.
The report's 24 recommendations were also met with broad community interest, Martin said. That's because nearly 10 billion food animals are raised and slaughtered in the United States for both domestic consumption and export. But 5 years after the commission's report was released, A new analysis by Johns Hopkins University Center for a Livable Future finds that the Obama administration and Congress have acted regressively towards industrial animal agriculture regulation and control. We'll start with the widespread use of antimicrobials and antibiotics.
Well, the Pew Commission recommended that the non-therapeutic use of antimicrobials in food animal production be banned. And we defined non-therapeutic by defining therapeutic, and we said that an approved use would be in the case of a veterinarian-diagnosed microbial disease. So, in other words, if the animal is sick, you treat the animal for the disease it has, the infection it has. We termed everything else non-therapeutic, including growth promotion and what the industry would call disease control.
The daily low-level use of antibiotics administered to animals. U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention attribute a pandemic of superbugs to a spike in antibiotics used in meat and poultry, as much as 30 million pounds in 2011. More than 2 million people get sick due to resistant bacteria every year, and more than 23,000 people die, says the CDC.
So there have been a couple of responses. There's a legislative response. It actually existed before the Pew Commission report. It's called the Preservation of Antibiotics for Medical Treatment Act, but interest in it had intensified after the Pew Commission report was released. Unfortunately, it's in the 5 years since the report was released, there's been no action on it.
The Obama administration's been developing new voluntary guidelines, but the Pew Commission seeks mandatory rules on therapeutic versus non-therapeutic use, as well as better tracking of disease outbreaks, such as avian influenza. Commissioners actually met with poultry integrators in Northwest Arkansas around 8 years ago. It's because Arkansas ranks second in the nation for broiler production. We have 3,300 industrial poultry feeding operations in Arkansas, along with nearly 600 CAFOs, farms that grow more than 125,000 birds per batch. All must register annually with local conservation districts, according to state law. The waste, called litter, is either spread on local farm fields or hauled to other farms to fertilize fields. Arkansas ranks 17th in the nation for beef production, counting nearly 2 million head, raised mostly on small-scale farms. But a new trend is emerging in Arkansas, industrial swine production. The state's first hog CAFO was permitted late last year on Newton County on the Buffalo National River watershed to house 6,500 sows, boars, and piglets. A second industrial swine farm was permitted October 11th on Yell County. It will house 4,300 swine. The farms produce liquid waste drained from barns into large lagoons and nets spread on farm fields as well. Nationwide, the commission says, such operations regulated by EPA and states produce 500 million metric tons of waste.
And EPA in 2012 started a CAFO inventory, but because of pressure to the industry, they backed off of that and stopped that, and actually have loosened their discharge requirements in permitting. So the permits aren't as meaningful as they used to be.
For a time, EPA had ruled all CAFOs must apply for National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permits, like sewage treatment plants. But pushback by industry successfully appealed the ruling, limiting NPDES permitting to farms that discharge directly into waterways, which links directly to the next issue, public health. Animal waste contains E. coli, nitrogen, and phosphorus, as well as pesticides, antibiotics, and hormones. And the commission found that communities near industrial animal farms may be at risk.
The particulate matter that is vented out of these operations have shown higher rates of asthma in people living close to them or asthma-like symptoms. And then the other thing is the pathogens that are in the waste generated by these operations that is spread untreated on surrounding farm fields, regardless of proximity to schools, public water supplies, churches, homes, lakes. So there are a lot of pathways to the community.
Animal welfare was also an issue the commission examined. For example, gestating swine confined to narrow crates for more than 3 months at a time and egg-laying hens confined to small mesh cages.
Yeah, the commission recommended to phase out battery cages, restrictive veal crates, and gestation crates, and there's not been much action at all on the federal level. However, there has been a number of states that have either voted through their state legislatures or through public referendums to ban either gestation crates or battery cages.
Martin says as more consumers look to purchase cage-free eggs and crate-free pork, industry practices will change. Still, most don't really care, given one out of four Americans consume fast food every day, which continues to drive the growth of industrial animal farming. But Robert Martin says even fast food franchises are adopting sustainable practices.
That is one of the strategies for people trying to foster change and advocate for change is to get large food retailers to agree to buy gestation crate-free pork, battery cage-free eggs, sustainably raised chicken. And some of them are committing to do that.
In their conclusion, Robert Martin and his colleagues at Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future look towards a new generation of farmers and researchers seeking to marry the science of ecology and evolutionary biology to design a new animal agriculture of the future. Then there's one other solution, cultured meat. Pork, beef, chicken, and fish grown from cells in pristine laboratory conditions. No more gestation crates, chicken trucks, slaughterhouses, or animal waste. Studies show manufactured meat uses 45% less energy, 99% less land, 96% less water, and creates 96% less greenhouse gas emissions. But it will be a while, maybe 2050, you'll be able to purchase cultured meat at your local grocer. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
To learn more about the Pew Commission on Industrial Farm Animal Production, you can go online to pcifap.org.
As we mentioned earlier in the program, there was a surprising political announcement in Arkansas yesterday. Tim Griffin, the Republican congressman from the state's 2nd District, says he will not seek a third term. Michael Hiblin from our content partner KUAR in Little Rock spoke to the congressman, and he has this report.
Congressman Griffin says he decided not to seek a third term so that he can spend more time with his wife and two kids.
A lot of stuff they do that I miss. I try to minimize that as much as possible, and you can't always avoid that. But, there's not a lot of flexibility in a congressional schedule because we meet when we meet. And so this is the best thing for my family.
The Republican from Arkansas' 2nd District says he doesn't know yet what he'll do after leaving Congress, but will return to Little Rock and expects to work in some form of public service. Griffin says the recent congressional fight over the government shutdown was not a factor in his decision. He made the decision now, he says, to give other Republicans time to consider running for his seat.
People talk about how they don't want lifetime politicians, and, you know, so I think for those folks, this is good. I mean, this is 4 years and working hard and giving somebody else an opportunity.
Griffin's decision caught even seasoned political observers off guard. Al Bass is a political scientist at Ouachita Baptist University.
Well, it's surprising, but I do think that political life does make great demands on an individual, you know, who accepts the call to public service. And I think there are a lot of sacrifices that one has to make if one's going to go all in.
Governor Mike Beebe.
I was surprised. I didn't know that. I mean, I don't know if anybody else knew it, but if they did, my sources didn't tell me that. So it was a well-kept secret.
Beebe says this gives Democrats a reasonably good chance at winning back the seat. Former North Little Rock Mayor Pat Hayes is expected to announce his candidacy. Also, a former campaign spokesman for former Lieutenant Governor Bill Halter put out a statement saying Halter would be the strongest Democratic candidate for the district. Former State Representative Linda Tyler and Conway Mayor Tab Townsell have also been mentioned as possible candidates. In Little Rock, I'm Michael Hiblin.
KUAF is supported by 121 Digital Marketing, a full-service digital agency helping local businesses with their online presence. Services include reputation and social media management, mobile and desktop website design and management, press releases, search engine marketing, and optimization. 121digitalmarketing.com for more information.
KUAF is also supported by Arcom Printing, located on the hillside just east of the Township and College intersection in Fayetteville. Arcom Printing provides printing, copying, and digital output services. Arcomprinting.com or 444-7711.
A panel of mental health and community assistance providers from Northwest Arkansas will discuss the intersection of the mental health and the criminal justice system and its implications for future mental health advocacy programs. The discussion is part of the fifth annual One Book, One Community project, which is focusing on mental health issues. The event will be held at 7 p.m. Tuesday, October 22nd, that's tonight, in St. Paul's Fellowship Hall in Fayetteville. The event is free and open to the public.
Congratulations to Chrissy Hallwalk, a teacher at Cooper Elementary School in Bentonville. She's been named the 2013 Arkansas History Teacher of the Year. The award is co-sponsored by the Gilder Lehrman Institute of American History and History, which used to be known as the History Channel on cable, and the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation on behalf of its Preserve America program. She's been teaching at Cooper Elementary since 2007, started working for the Bentonville Public School District in 2004, 22 years of experience with a master's degree from Harding University. She'll receive a $1,000 honorarium and will be in the running to be named the 2013 National History Teacher of the Year this fall. Cooper Elementary School Library, by the way, will receive a core archive of history books.
The Fayetteville Visitors Bureau will host the 12th annual Trick or Treat on the Square Thursday, October 31st from 3 to 5 p.m. on the downtown Fayetteville Square. Trick or Treat on the Square will feature carnival games, face painting, and candy for all participating children. Dog Party USA will be hosting a pet costume contest. Terra Studios will host a troll photo booth. Following Trick or Treat on the Square, the inaugural Halloween Monster Dash will take place at 6 p.m. The race will be a Halloween-themed 5K and fun run involving a costume contest, candy treats along the course, kids' fun zone with bouncy houses and inflatables, and an interactive carnival. Each participant will be given a Halloween Monster Dash candy bag, and there will be several candy stations along the course to gather candy. The streets on the Fayetteville Square will be blocked to oncoming traffic for the safety of those attending the event.
I love that there's a 5K where when you stop, you get candy.
Yeah.
It kind of balances.
It seems like motivation. This might be one I could run.
And it's also, you know, balancing out the calories you get with the candy.
Sure.
Eat some candy corn, then go
another
kilometer.
I don't know that I would eat it while I was running.
No.
That doesn't seem like a good idea for me.
No, I don't think it's a good idea to eat candy while you run. And Michael Nick Nichols, National Geographic Editor-at-Large for Photography, will speak and show photographs from his recent work Tuesday night, November 12th at 7 in Hillside Auditorium at the University of Arkansas. The presentation is free of charge. No tickets are required. He recently published the book Earth to Sky, Among Africa's Elephants, A Species in Crisis. The book will be available for sale at the lecture, and he'll sign copies after he speaks.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, world-famous chef Daniel Boulud has a new cookbook. He calls himself an American chef with a French soul and a French chef with an American soul.
Being able to borrow from other cuisine or from other palate and still remain French in the core of your cuisine.
Daniel Boulud, next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Listen today from 1 to 3 p.m. to KUAF.
It is Tuesday, October 22nd. This is Ozarks at Large. With me on the phone is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I'm back.
Yes,
oh, wait, wrong movie. I'm back. I'm just not there with you.
That's right.
I promise I will be.
Yeah, you'll come back in studio later this week.
I will. But I have arrived from Austin and would really like to take off to Eureka Springs this weekend because it is the annual Ozark Folk Festival.
The, what, 63rd, 64th?
Something ridiculous
Yeah. Like
that. And they're bringing back Michael Jonathan's Wood Songs radio program this year. They started that last year and recorded, and he will be back this year on Saturday. Plus, there's a gospel brunch, a parade, a songwriters contest, and Michael Martin Murphy will perform Saturday night.
Yes, he will. And these programs, the Wood Songs programs, are being recorded, and they will be broadcast on public television, on public radio stations, including KUAF and the Armed Forces Service Network. This is a genuine worldwide audience.
And you can find out more and make your plans at OzarksFolkFestival.com.
And we're excited because he is scheduled to be in our studios and on Ozarks at Large Friday. So stay tuned to that, too.
Cool.
Yeah. Becca Martin Brown is Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Autumn is a busy time for area theater. Almost every stage will have something set for production between now and Thanksgiving. In a moment, we'll have a sneak preview of an original work from Arts Life Theater that is ideal for another autumnal holiday, Halloween.
Before we get to Zombies on Stage, some reminders of other theater opportunities approaching. Fayetteville High School will present Through These Eyes. It's a new play about self-image. It will be staged October 25th and 26th in the Fayetteville High School Performing Arts Center. Through These Eyes is designed to help teen audiences have a healthier view of who they are and who they can become. Curtain time is 7 o'clock each night. Tickets $7 for students, $8 for non-students. For more information or tickets, 445-1193.
Rogers Little Theater's upcoming production of Don't Dress for Dinner by Mark Camaletti and adapted by Robin Hodden will run November 1st through the 3rd and the 7th through the 10th at the Victory Theater, which is located in downtown Rogers. Thursday through Saturday, doors open for dinner seating starting at 6:30 p.m. and dinner is served at until 7:30. Balcony seating begins at 7:30 and the performance begins at 8. Sunday, doors open for dinner theater seating at 12:30. Dinner is served until 1:30. Balcony seating starts also at 1:30 and the performance begins at 2.
John Brown University Musical Theater presents Patience, a comic operetta in two acts by Gilbert and Sullivan. The show takes audiences to Victorian England, in which young maidens try to understand true love and young men try to understand young women. The show runs November 8th through the 10th and 15th and 16th in the Barry Performing Arts Center on the campus of John Brown University. For more information, you can call the JBU box office. That's 524-7382. You can also go online to jbu.edu/tickets.
The Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale presents No Sex, Please, We're British this weekend, October 25th through the 27th, and next weekend, November 1st through the 2nd. A young bride living above a bank with her husband innocently sends a mail order off for some Scandinavian glassware, but what comes back is Scandinavian pornography. The plot revolves around the veritable floods of photographs, books, films, and eventually girls that arrive. To purchase tickets, you can visit artscenteroftheozarks.org.
Theater's youth production of Peter Pan runs Saturday and Sunday with performances at 2 and 5 each day in Walton Arts Center Star Theater, waltonartscenter.org, or 443-5600 for more information. And Fort Smith Little Theater is gearing up for the holiday season with Irving Berlin's White Christmas. A gala performance takes place November 14th, regular performances November 15th, 16th, 19th through the 23rd, and a special matinee performance November 17th.
University of Arkansas Theater's season continues with She Stoops to Conquer, Friday, November 15th through the 17th, and November 20th through the 24th. The show is a comedy by the Irish author Oliver Goldsmith. The play was initially titled as Mistakes of the Night, and the events in the play indeed happened during the time frame of one night. Drama.uark.edu for more information and to purchase tickets.
And lights up!
A group of about 15 zombies, aged 10 to 17, make their way from various corners of the Arts Live Theater in Fayetteville to join one another on stage. The 16 actors and actresses are taking part in the youth theater group's Halloween play, A Zombie High School Homecoming. The play is written by Arts Live veteran Reed Carson for an Arts Live original production, the first full-length play to be written by one of the kids. A junior in high school, Reed says he has been writing shows with his friends for as long as he can remember.
We'd write a show, kind of. We'd rehearse it, and then we'd show it to our parents. They were always murder mysteries. I don't know why we did that, but we were too young for that. But I don't know. I've been writing for a while. I wrote a skit for my talent show in third grade. But then in sixth grade, I wrote a like 30-minute sketch for my talent show called Deal or No Deal, a parody.
Arts Live executive director Mark Landon Smith had the storyline, but approached Reed to pin the script. At over an hour in length, A Zombie High School Homecoming is much longer than the short films and skits he was used to writing, as well as having a much larger cast. Thanks to television shows like The Walking Dead, zombies are a trendy thing of late, making it easy for Reed to get some inspiration.
I guess my thing that got me really into zombies was the film Zombieland. I watched it It was one of like the first rated R movies I saw, and I loved it. I don't know, just like that way of, it's like a juxtaposition between, you know, zombies and then a hilarious comedy storyline. So I don't know. Yeah, I like zombies more than vampires or whatever.
He says that the film was the first thing that came to his mind when he was approached with this idea. He knew it was a comedy, but didn't want to parody zombies. He wanted zombies in a real-world setting and to make it funny, and for the actors to play actors, telling the story of the event to the audience.
Shut up. He was talking about the audience.
Oh. Oh, well, what are they doing here?
I'm not sure. Maybe they want to hear the story.
What story?
The story.
The story?
Yes, the story about the zombies and the end of the world and how everyone died.
Oh, that story. Don't worry, when she says the end of the world and everyone dies, she doesn't mean it.
Yeah, that's just zombie rule number 23.
All zombie stories from Night of the Living Dead to World War Z have something to do with the end of the world and everyone dying.
And a group of soul survivors seeking refuge in old jailhouses or an island off the coast of L.A.
A zombie high school homecoming is about a zombie named Kay Daver, who was woken up from her death. She can talk and has feelings, having yet to evolve into the thoughtless and staggering zombies we're all familiar with. Upon awakening, Kay stumbles into a high school.
But homecoming is coming up, and it's a horrible time of the year, trust me. Just everyone is asking everyone, and you feel this pressure on you to get asked or to be asked or to ask. And she's just thrust into this world because she didn't remember anything from her past live life. But she's just thrust into this world of high school, and there's the mean cliquey girls and the jocks and the weirdos and the outcasts.
Kay meets this one guy who is kind of a jock, but there's something else about him, and they fall in love, taking a weird trip down a road of people disapproving of their relationship. Then someone finds out she's a zombie for sure. The show is complete with a villain who tries to get rid of Kay. 10-year-old Ashley Keltspeaker is dressed in a white and red coat and hat, a little large for her small size, but necessary for the role.
Meeker Scanty, the villain, it's very fun because I get to do an evil laugh. And I like it when I get pushed out. Mwah-ha-ha-ha! I have to do it really long, though, because I have to run out the back.
This is Ashley's second time acting with Arts Live, and she says it's fun to be someone else for a little while. Upon completion of the script, Reed had to relinquish control and turn the play over to director Jules Taylor. He knew that that was what was going to happen, but still found it difficult. Jules says she hardly had any notes when she first read it, and is proud of the work that makes her laugh out loud.
Well, it's very, very spoofish. It's kind of a spoofy, silly, funny little show. It's got a lot of, you know, puns and jokes. I would say, you know, High School Musical or even Glee without the music. There's no music, but kind of like that whole idea of the high school meets, you know, Twilight or something. It's just kind of like a combination, but yet it's all done tongue-in-cheek.
Having been with Arts Live for 9 years, Jules says she is blessed to work with kids and is constantly amazed with their creativity, having to give little direction on how to be a zombie.
They all have their own conception of what it should be. And like that first scene, you know, when they all come out as a zombie, I just told them, you know, do what you think a zombie would do. And they all came up with hilarious little walks and moves. That's all them. That was not me at all. That's all the kids coming up with it. Their own unique zombie-isms.
As mentioned earlier, Kay Daver is the main zombie, having to maintain her zombie-isms the entire length of the play. First-time Arts Live actress Macy McDowell has that starring role. A senior at Shiloh Christian School, it was a role she was very excited to get.
I was in the middle of a history class, actually, and I was like, I have to leave. And I got up and ran to my drama teacher's room and told her, and she was so excited too, so that was cool.
As the play begins and the zombies make their way to the stage and explain the story to the audience, Kay, played by Macy, must lie at center stage for a good 10 minutes, playing dead and not moving.
That's actually one of the scariest things I can think of, is lying on the ground and having 10 to 15-year-olds standing over me. But it's definitely interesting.
A zombie lover herself, Macy says one of her favorite things is all of the humor written into her lines.
Every line is tainted with some sort of reference to something else. There's a lot of Shakespeare references, which I adore because I'm a Shakespeare junkie. So he's done a really good job of doing that.
During rehearsal, other references like to Full House and the film Zombieland can be heard. Though not all references may be understood by a younger audience, a zombie high school homecoming is suitable for those aged 6 years and older and can be seen Thursday, October 31st through Sunday, November 3rd. Tickets and more information can be found at artslivetheater.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
This is Ozarks at Large. You don't have to search very hard for political movements claiming they have the very core of the United States Constitution as their inspiration. Depending on the ideological bent of an organization, the document is being protected, embraced, or attacked almost every day. Sanford Levinson, a constitutional law scholar, has interest in how Americans perceive the Constitution, though he says we tend to pay too much attention to certain parts and not enough attention to others. And he contends we certainly don't have enough rational national conversations about the Constitution. He's written the book, Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance, and he's on the faculty of the University of Texas Law School. Last month, Sanford Levinson spoke at the University of Arkansas. His topic of discussion, how the concepts of secession and nullification matter in 2013. During his visit to Fayetteville, he also came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk about the Constitution. I first asked him about secession, a matter that I suggested may have been put to rest at Appomattox nearly 150 years ago.
People who think about secession in America should begin with the American Revolution, should include Vermont, should include the Texas secession from Mexico, Maine's secession from Massachusetts. And, I mean, I've gone so far as to argue, and I think this is an overstatement, but at least before 1861 or 1865, you could argue that in some ways in America, secession is as American as apple pie. I mean, you look at church history in America, and you can view Protestantism as a secessionist movement from the Roman Catholic Church, but especially, I grew up in North Carolina, especially in you know, the southern states, you realize that the great denominations were not able to maintain themselves, they were always facing secessionist movements.
Sanford Levinson's address on the University of Arkansas campus last month addressed the concept of nullification as well as secession. Nullification is the idea that a state has the legal right to invalidate a federal law that the particular state has declared unconstitutional. Often supporters of an act of nullification cite the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, 28 words that have been debated over since they were first written. One political group, the 10th Amendment Center, advocates for what it calls strict adherence to the 10th Amendment to ensure what it calls true liberty for all. Others think the idea of nullification, like the idea of secession, is a bit of a relic.
One article refers to these ideas as zombie constitutionalism, that is, ideas really arising from the dead. Another very interesting book referred to kind of dinosaur constitutionalism, which is to say ideas that really once were alive and well and had real substance behind them. The first secessionist movements in the United States, besides the Revolution, took place in New England, the Hartford Convention. There were people who talked about secession. It was the abolitionists. It was William Lloyd Garrison who burnt either the flag or the Constitution and said no union with slaveholders, which is certainly a defensible position. So, but I think there was this feeling that however large and powerful these ideas were, they became extinct because of the Civil War and Appomattox. But you see people trying to revive them. And so with regard to nullification, the other side of the coin, just north of here, Missouri passed a law that on its face seemed to declare illegal federal gun legislation. And no competent lawyer would say that the state has the power to do that, but this is drawing on certain arguments from the American past. And Missouri isn't alone. Now, it happened ultimately that the Missouri legislature, by one vote, failed to override the governor's veto. But you look at a lot of states, and I think Arkansas might be one of them, where you find members of the legislature who say, in effect, you know, pound the table, I'm so mad, or we all are so mad, we're just not going to take it anymore. And what the state should do is to say the feds not only shouldn't do this, but can't do it. The 10th Amendment says that those powers not assigned to the national government are reserved to the states and to the people. Nobody really can take exception with that. The Supreme Court, in a decision in, I think it was 1941, said this is a truism. If the national government doesn't have powers, then somebody else does, and it would be either states or the people. But the 10th Amendment does not supply you with a clue as to what powers have in fact been assigned to the national government. Also, the 10th Amendment lacks a certain very important word, expressly, because the Articles of Confederation that the Constitution replaced included the term expressly when it was talking about the relationship between the national government established by the Articles and states. So it said if it's not expressly given to the national government, they don't have it. There was a motion made in the Senate to add, or the House, doesn't matter, to add expressly to the 10th Amendment. It failed. And it failed because people like James Madison and others believed that the government established under the Articles was, in their own terms, imbecilic. And what they wanted to do was to create a national government with enough power to meet whatever were the felt problems of the time. So I don't think the 10th Amendment helps you very much. It reminds you that the national government is limited in what it can do, but everybody agrees with that. What we don't agree on is what the specific limits are.
Sanford Levinson says, for all the great debate we have as a nation over particular parts of the Constitution, the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, we as a nation pay too little time to trying to understand the other ideas and laws included in the amendments that shape how our government works. Amendments that are not often fodder for bumper sticker slogans. He says he thinks the national conversation should pay heed to these concepts as well.
The most important parts of the Constitution are the ones, in fact, we never think about. What people shout and yell at each other about are the rights provisions of the Constitution. What's the meaning of free speech? What's the meaning of free exercise of religion? What in the world is the meaning of equal protection of the laws? I'm not saying these aren't important questions. What I am saying is that, first of all, they're subjects of endless arguments, and they're also subject to almost endless change. We've seen it in our own lifetimes. We've certainly seen it over history. Depending on who wins elections and appoints judges, you will get very different interpretations of all of these three amendments that I mentioned. Some people will be very happy. Some people will be very angry about the changes, but you're going to get changes. I believe that at the end of the day, the most important parts of the Constitution that explain why most people these days really are alienated, particularly from the national government, the approval rate of Congress on a good day will get above 15%. Often in recent years, it's been about 10%. And I've suggested that if you had had polls in 1776, that King George might have done better than the current Congress does. What I think frustrates people, and I don't think it matters whether you're in the left, right, or center on this, is a perception that whatever you believe are the main issues of the day, they're not being handled by Congress. Congress has become, depending on your point of view, a group of kindergartners, a group of terrorists, a group of whatever, fill in the blank. But nobody looks at Congress these days and says, you know, this is a group of fine, upstanding people really doing their best for the country. I don't think that Congress is composed of a bunch of scoundrels. At one level, I think this is probably the least corruption-free Congress in our history, if you define corruption as taking bribes. You know, in the old days, you could find people who were really selling their vote for cash. You can occasionally find this in some state legislatures, and state legislators regularly go to prison for bribery. It's been a long time since anything like that has happened at the national level. So it's not that kind of personal corruption that is the problem. Rather, it's a constitutional system that has never made its peace with the fact that we have political parties who are divided, and we have this remarkably complicated checks and balances, division of powers system that generates tons of opportunities to veto legislation, to block legislation you don't like, and makes it at times almost a miracle to pass legislation about controversial subjects.
Sanford Levinson says for all the great debate we have as a nation over particular parts of the Constitution, the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, we as a nation pay too little time to trying to understand the other ideas and laws included in the amendments that shape how our government works. Amendments that are not often fodder for bumper sticker slogans. He says he thinks the national conversation should pay heed to these concepts as well.
I think that a lot of people think they know about the dull and boring details of the Constitution because maybe when they were in the seventh grade, they suffered through a civics course in which they learned, quote, how a bill becomes a law. The question I wish people would ask themselves is why do most bills stand no chance at all of becoming a law? And what I think, what I want people to do is not to go back and read the text of the 10th Amendment or the 14th Amendment. I'm not opposed to that. But I do think that actually more people than you may think are really familiar with the Second Amendment, the 10th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, because there are political movements that are built around one or another. There's something called the 10th Amendment Foundation that's very influential among political conservatives. And I suspect that a lot of members of the Tea Party can recite the 10th Amendment. Most people, even if they're dimly aware that we have the system for passing legislation that we do, don't really reflect on the fact that we have a bicameral system with a death ray veto of one branch of Congress over the other. But in a way, it gets even worse because the president has the veto power to make irrelevant what Congress passes. So ordinarily, we believe that the United States is a bicameral political system at the national level. I argue, no, we're a tricameral political system because of the role the president has in shaping legislation. And depending on your view of the Supreme Court, we could be viewed as a quadricameral. We came one vote from the Supreme Court simply negating the primary achievement of the Obama administration that would never have happened if both houses of Congress hadn't supported it. And so I say it's not that people might not know this in the back of their minds, but I don't think that they really reflect on it. There is no debate taking place in this country today of a kind that was taking place 100 years ago during the progressive movement. So I would love for people to read what they mistakenly believe are the dull and boring parts of the Constitution, the part of the Constitution that gives Wyoming the same vote in the Senate as California. That's extremely important. The fixed-term presidency, I think that it is a defect in our political system that we can't fire a president we've lost confidence in. And I could march through some other sorts of things. So these are the parts of the Constitution that I really wish people would read and debate with their fellow citizens about. You know, 10th Amendment, 14th Amendment, First Amendment, Second Amendment, people ought to read them as well. But there's already enough debate that goes on about them.
Sanford Levinson is a constitutional law scholar and is the author of the book Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. He spoke last month on the University of Arkansas campus. This is Ozarks at Large. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF is supported by the fully remodeled and expanded Walmart Museum, a family-friendly experience featuring interactive displays on the history of Walmart, Walton's Five and Dime, and the Spark Cafe Soda Fountain. Located on the square in downtown Bentonville and open daily until 9 p.m., including Sundays, 277-8493 or facebook.com/Walmart Museum. For more information,
a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Brashears.
Brashears.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of over there by Patrick and Combs.
Yep, sure is.
Right.
Madison County.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You spent some time out in the more wilderness parts of our listening area this weekend,
sure,
did you not?
If you want to call it that. It's a big open field.
Yeah.
Yes, I went to Harvest Festival.
Yonder Mountain String Bands Harvest Music Festival.
Yes, thank you. I wasn't even going to try to attempt that. But yes, Harvest Festival. Went down Thursday, came back, did some work Friday, went back down Friday, and stayed until we came home on Sunday.
And
yeah.
Any rain?
Yes.
Okay. I was out of town, so I don't know if it rained or not.
I didn't think there was rain in the forecast. And then when I came into the office Friday morning, our general manager, Rick Stockdale, had mentioned something about rain. I said, no, you're kidding, right? And I looked, and there definitely was a little bit of rain. But I'm like, okay, might not rain. Talked to one of my friends down there, and he's like, no, it's definitely raining right now. So it rained most of Friday afternoon.
I think the organizers of the festivals on Mulberry Mountain could pay you a certain amount every year just not to go.
I think so. I'm starting to think it's my fault.
Every time you go to one of these.
Every time I've gone to Mulberry Mountain, it has rained. So I'm starting to feel bad about this.
Okay. Well,
I mean,
I'm sure it's not you.
I'm sure it's not me. But it was a good time. There was lots of good music. And if you want to see some pictures, we'll have a link up at our blog, kuaf.com/mixdown today.
Oh, very good. And don't forget, the KUAF on-air fundraiser will begin Thursday morning. That's October 24th, the day after tomorrow.
Oh, yes. Yes. And we will go until October 31st.
Till Halloween.
Halloween. And we have been collecting money all month. Anything that people mail in or pledge online, all of that goes to our goal for our October fundraiser. So you can do that at supportkuaf.com.
That's right. And anything we get now, of course, as Antoinette just mentioned, goes to the total, so we get there faster,
yep,
is the idea.
That's the idea.
Appreciate it. You can also mail your contribution in now. Our address, 9 South School, Fayetteville, and that's a 72701 zip code. Sometime I'm going to have to tell you about duck pin bowling. I think it would become your new
duck
favorite.
Duck pin bowling?
Yes, I did that this weekend in Baltimore. It's like 10-pin bowling, but with a ball that you can palm that weighs only a couple of pounds, and the pins are very tiny.
I mean, I already have to get a ball that only weighs a couple of pounds. It's kind of sad. I'm like one step removed from the child's ball.
Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Thanks so much for listening.